Thank you very much. So today I want to pick up where some of my collaborators and also Eve this morning left us, and our chair advised me to be provocative, so I will take this opportunity to highlight some of, or contrast some of our predictions with that of others, and hopefully we can return to that in the discussion. So my talk will be divided in roughly two sections, and the first one I will revisit the origin of the Kennicott-Schmidt law as being set by a global balance between stellar feedback and gravity in galactic disk in a manner very similar to what Eve explained this morning. And because of that, I will go very quickly through this part and focus on a test that I would like to advocate of this picture based on the dependence of the soft formation efficiencies of galaxies on the gas mass fraction. The final point that I will make is that in this physical picture, the rate limiting step for star formation in galaxies is really on relatively large scales. That is the rate of formation of the most massive Kardashian bound clouds, or the GMCs. And this is something that we are using in this FIRE cosmological simulation project that you have already heard from Phil and Dushan earlier this week. And what I will discuss there is early predictions for the circumgalactic medium properties from these simulations. Okay. One of the points which I want to address directly in this presentation is on what scale is star formation regulated inside galaxies. And there have really been two classes of models that have been popularized in the literature over the past few years. The first one is a local class of models in which star formation on galactic scales is slow because it is slow in molecular clouds where stars are forming. And this class of models is exemplified by the supersonic turbulence theories that Mark and his collaborators in particular have developed, and which are based on the density PDF for supersonically turbulence gas like Noam described yesterday. And in at least some of these theories, one of the predictions is that the star formation efficiency per free-fall time is over the 1%, but furthermore nearly universal in the sense that it does not depend very sensitively on the conditions of the molecular cloud or on the properties of the galaxy that hosts them. Okay? Now there's a second class of star formation regulation theories that we've actually heard more about this week. And it's a class of theories in which the regulation occurs on larger scales in galaxies via global balance between gravity and stellar feedback. And in those theories, it's not necessary for star formation to be very inefficient on small scales where the free fall times are short, because the bottleneck is really on a larger scale in the galaxy. These I will refer to as feedback-regulated models, and Eve very nicely described her implementation of such a model. I note, interestingly, that both of these classes of theories have very strong roots in Berkeley, so we are friends, and it's a very healthy debate to have. So what I will do for the next few slides is describe our particular implementation of a feedback-regulated analytic model for the Kennicott-Schmidt law. The first part will be very similar to what Eve described, and then I will extend it somewhat and propose this test based on the gas mass fractions of galaxies. Okay, so because Eve already described this very nicely, I'll go through this very quickly. So what we imagine is that we have a galactic disk in which young stars are forming. This galactic disk has a mean gas density rho bar, a characteristic thickness little h, and we use these big sigmas to denote the gas surface density in the galactic disk and its star formation rate surface density. We parameterize the efficiency of stellar feedback by this number, p star over m star, which is simply the momentum that's injected in the stellar medium per stellar mass form. And as you mentioned, for supernovae, this number is about 3,000 kilometers per second, and it varies very weakly with ambient gas density. The characteristic turbulent velocity of the largest eddies was simply denoted by V turbulent. And the postulate in this theory is simply that the turbulent pressure, on average, balances the weight of the disk gas per unit area, something that I also called the gap national pressure. And simply by noticing that the rate at which turbulent energy is injected in the ISM has to equal the rate at which it's dissipated, we can derive an expression for this turbulent pressure, and it's simply linearly proportional to the star formation rates of Earth's density times P star over M star. And notice that this has the correct units of momentum per unit time per unit area, whereas the gravitational pressure is simply proportional to Newton's constant times the square of the gas of Earth's density. So equating those two simple expressions, we are directly led to a prediction for the relationship between star formation rates of Earth's density and gas of Earth's density. And that's exactly what Eve showed earlier this morning. And notice that in this theory, the normalization of the Kennicott-Schmidt law is set by a ratio which quantifies the strength of gravity, that's Newton's constant, divided by P star of M star, which quantifies the strength of stellar feedback. And we can compare, like Eve did, the prediction of this model with observed galaxies in the local universe in blue and at high redshift in red. And let me further note that this compilation of galaxies includes both galaxies that are in a state of mergers and non-merging galaxies. There's one assumption that I have had to make for this comparison, and it is in converting the CO line intensities that are actually observer galaxies to gas surface densities, which is what I plot here. And what I have assumed is that XCO, the CO conversion factor, varies continuously, with the main parameter being the gas surface density, and that continuous fit was simply pegged to the standard Milky Way value at a low gas surface density and a standard Euler-like value at higher gas surface densities, something that also Eve did in her work and that was supported by a number of radiative transfer calculations subsequently. But I will come back to this particular assumption in just a couple of slides. So one thing that we did, though, that is, I think, somewhat different from what Eve did is that we put in an additional assumption in the model that disks also regulate themselves to have a turmeric Q parameter of order unity. And if you add this assumption on top of global hydrostatic balance, you can make another prediction and phrase it in terms of the gas mass fraction that's turned into stars per freefall time in the galaxy. So that's epsilon freefall on galactic scale. And simple algebra tells you that this is determined by a very simple dimensionless ratio, which involves the gas mass fraction of galaxies, F sub g, and their circular velocity. So this is a product that quantifies the strength of the gravity acting on the gas, because V sub c is a proxy for the depth of the gravitational potential well. And the denominator here is what quantifies the strength of stellar feedback. For typical galaxies, the gas mass fraction might be of order 10%, V sub c of order 250 kilometers per second, like the Milky Way, whereas P star over M star for supernovae is about 3,000. So the ratio is indeed 1%, and I think that is a very simple way of understanding why galaxies convert, on average, only about 1% of their disk gas mass per freefall time. But one prediction of this model is that this particular efficiency is on average 1%, but it's not universal in the sense that it varies in a systematic way from galaxy to galaxy, in particular with the gas mass fraction. And here I've compared the same galaxies as on the previous slide and inferred the epsilon freefall and plotted it as a function of FG times VC, the parameter that's predicted to determine it in our model. And you can see that there is, I think, a clear upwards trend as predicted, but a more quantitative way, and actually a better way of testing the model prediction, is in the plot on the right-hand side, in which a solid curve is actually mathematically equivalent to this prediction here, but simply plotted in a parameter space that has the advantage that the vertical axis, the star formation rate of the galaxy, is actually independent of the combination of quantities that enter in the horizontal axis, including the gas mass of the galaxy, the half-life radius, and P star over M star. Okay, and I think that the fact that the data have the same slope here as this model prediction supports real galaxies having the epsilon FF on galactic scale scaling with gas mass fraction. And this is something that I'm sure we will return to in the discussion, but I believe that this is in tension with some of the supersonic turbulence models that would predict that this is a constant from galaxy to galaxy. And a further prediction that you can make from this model, which follows from q is equal to 1, is that the turbulence velocity also scales with gas mass fraction in galaxies. And if that's correct, then there's a simple way of understanding why Euler's and high redshift star forming galaxies would have elevated gas turbulence velocity dispersion. And this is simply because they have elevated gas mass fractions. Okay. Now, the agreement between the theoretical prediction here and the data depends somewhat on the assumption that we have made regarding the conversion from CO line intensity to CO gas mass. And these are just the plots on the two previous slides. And what I will now show on the right-hand side is the same analysis, but in which I have made the more common assumption of a bimodal XCO using a Milky Way-like values for ordinary disk galaxies and a Euler-like value for the starburst galaxies. And in that case, the agreement with the model is somewhat spoiled, but let me point out that the scatter in that the data is significantly enhanced. And I believe that absent a conspiracy, this suggests that the continuous XCO assumption is at least a better approximation to reality. Now, so far I've implicitly had in mind galactic disks that are relatively smooth and time steady, but we know observationally that star formation in galaxies is very clumpy. In the Milky Way, about a third of the current star formation occurs in only 33 giant molecular clouds. And that's reflected by the clumpiness of the ionizing radiation that we see from the plane of our own galaxy. Now, in my talk, what I refer to as GMCs is really the most massive Kraft-Schneeband clouds in the ISM. So they have a characteristic mass, simply the characteristic mass for Kraft-Schneeband stability, or the Thumri mass. And in the Milky Way, the Thumri mass is about a million solar masses. That's, in fact, comparable to the mass of the most massive GMCs that we have in our galaxy. But the Thumri mass is predicted to be quite a bit larger in high redshift star forming galaxies that are much more gas rich, in fact, over the billion solar masses. And in those galaxies, we observe Kraft-Schneeband clouds that have masses of this order of magnitude. And that's a point that Avishai has stressed very nicely over the years. The reason that I emphasize these masses is that we can actually directly resolve them in our best cosmological hydrodynamical simulations today. And this is significant because in this picture for global feedback regulation of star formation that I have advocated, the formation is really the rate-limiting step. More specifically, what I have in mind is a picture in which young stars drive stellar feedback, excite turbulence in galactic disk, and that's what maintains them in a state of marginal Kraft-Schneeband stability, that is, on average, a Thumri Q parameter of order unity. And this provides a mechanism for throttling the rates of formation of new GMCs by determining the probability with which stochastic density fluctuations in the ISM can actually become self-gravitating. And ultimately, this provides a mechanism to throttle the global rate of star formation in the galaxy so as to satisfy, on average, vertical hydrostatic balance and explain the Kennicott-Schmidt law. And the major implication of this physical picture is that to make meaningful predictions for star formation in simulations, it's actually not necessary to resolve the formation of individual stars, but rather that the most important steps are to resolve the formation of GMCs, which we can actually do, but only if we simultaneously model the impact of stellar feedback processes, which is what drives turbulence and throttles the rate of GMC formation. And to some degree, this has been explicitly verified in numerical simulations like the one that Phil showed on day one of this conference. Okay, so in the second part of the talk, I want to describe this simulation project, FIRE, that you've heard about already, in which we are really using some of these physical ideas to implement star formation in cosmological simulations. And what I will focus on today are predictions from these simulations for the circumgalactic medium absorption in neutral hydrogen around high redshift galaxies and for the metallicity distribution of Lyman limit systems observed by the cosmic origin spectrograph below redshift of 1 or so. So FIRE, as you've heard already, stands for Feedback in Realistic Environments. So this is our attempt to implement stellar feedback in cosmological simulations. We use a zoom-in technique. And one of the key things that we do is that we make sure that we resolve the formation of giant molecular clouds in our simulated galaxies, which is important because, like I argued, that's the rate-limiting step for star formation. And we only allow gas to form or to be converted in stars in dense, locally self-gravitating regions where the details of the star formation prescriptions don't affect the global predictions very much. We implement approximations for the energy and momentum return from a number of stellar feedback processes, including supernovae, photonization, stellar winds, and radiation pressure. And we do that directly following the predictions of Starburst 99, a stellar population synthesis model. And we really have not tuned the parameters of our simulations to match a priori known observations. Rather, we put in what was really our genuine best guess for galaxy formation physics today. We have run the simulations, and we are now engaged in comparing them with a number of observations to test exactly how well we are doing. In particular, predictions like, or things like the Kennecott-Schmidt law or the galactic winds that we find in these calculations are really predictions of the model rather than ingredients that were put in. And this is a movie from one of our simulations that I think you've seen before. It's color-coded by gas temperature, so red is about 1,000,000 degrees Kelvin. Green 10 to the 4, and purple about 100 degrees Kelvin or so. So it tends to trace the dense cold ISM in galaxies where stars actually form. And at redshift of 0, this particular simulation tracks a dark matter halo of mass 10 to the 12, comparable to our own Milky Way. So what I am doing with these simulations is study the circumgalactic medium. And these simulations, I believe, are very well suited to do that because we have good reasons to believe that they predict at least more realistic multi-phase gas structures than many previous calculations in the literature. These reasons include the fact that we use a hydro solver.
And if you're dealing with a smooth medium, then that isn't a problem. But if the medium's very clumpy or not, as in your simulations, and you average over a bigger volume, then there's a worry there about getting the correct statistics for these objects compared to the simulations. I mean, it's just an inherent difficulty, I think, in making these kinds of comparisons.
Yeah, that's a great comment. That's actually something that I have been aware of, and I think it's important to be cautious about. If we find discrepancy between the models and the observations, it's not. It could be because of reasons other than incorrect physics.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah, very nice work. You pointed out the difference at redshift 2 to 3 for one of your galaxies in particular, that at redshift of 3 you had infall, and then at redshift of 2 you had outflow. In terms of looking at the Lyman alpha characteristics of those galaxies, yeah. We see in LBGs, we see redshifted Lyman alpha always. Do you have any idea what... whether you'd see in the infall stage, whether you'd see a prominent blue peak?
Yeah, so I have not calculated this, but when you have an outflow, as you know, that tends to create redshifted peaks in, through the Lyman alpha radiative transfer. And my graduate student is actually looking at Lyman alpha emission properties from these simulations, and we have a scattering code that will be able to answer this type of question. So my suspicion is that the answer is yes, but I haven't shown it.
Hey, so, Claude-André, I have to pick a bone with your gas fraction epsilon FF because
yes.
I actually just worked out from... So all of your values of epsilon FF that are up at 10% are galaxies from Linda Tacconi's sample. And the reason you get high epsilon FF is because you use a different XCO than the one she recommends.
Correct.
So, regardless, we can argue about whether that's reasonable or not, but I just wanted to point out, so I just did the calculation of, if your epsilon FF is right, what is the average density that has to be put in to get epsilon FF of 0.1? And the answer is, you have to believe that the average density of the CO emitting gas in those galaxies is one particle per cc. So we don't know of any galaxies where gas at a density of one particle per cc it has CO in it.
Well, this free fall time that I'm plotting is not necessarily the free fall time in the molecular gas, right? It's a free fall time at the average density of the galaxy. which is not necessarily the free-fall time that you have in some of your papers, but I think it's the relevant free-fall time to compare our model prediction with.
Well, okay, but then there's no tension with the supersonic model because that's a prediction about the rate at which stars form in molecular clouds, not a prediction I guess what I'd say is, you know, if you plug in the mean density of the Milky Way's ISM, you also get one particle per cc, and epsilon FF looks big, but that is in no contradiction to the models of, you know, that doesn't disagree with what we said.
It's actually much lower because for your volume, you're using the whole radius of the galaxy, not the distance.
No, that I don't think.
I think you
are. Well, okay, let me show you something. So K, we should probably return to this offline. But this is,
as
Mark knows, we've had many email exchanges about this. But this is a processing of the same data that I plotted on my slide, but in which I have used the exact formulae in Mark, Avishai, and Chris's paper.
That's still your XCO.
Still my XCO, that's correct.
Yes,
okay, that's right. So if I use, actually I had it on a slide. Yeah, so if you use Tacconi's XCO, you get this. So it spoils the trend. So the trend. No, I think if you use your formula, then you get this, but you have a lower normalization.
I think we should continue this offline. Okay. Next question. Yes.
Very nice results. Phil was showing that if you go to massive galaxies, things go wrong, and he was appealing to the need for AGN. The Lyman Break galaxies you are comparing with are 10 to the 12 solar mass halos, so they are at a regime where you might expect AGN to already be doing some damage. So can you speculate? Do you think that might matter for your?
I can speculate. So I don't know the answer. So our philosophy with respect to AGN so far is that we don't know how to implement it very predictively. And so we have chosen to focus on the stellar feedback physics and quantify the observations that we can explain absent AGN feedback. Now, as you know, there's another observed data point, which Prochaska and his collaborator, that would be like here. It would be a factor, it's at like 0.65 for slightly more massive halos. So the covering fraction of dense neutral hydrogen in those quasar-hosting halos is drastically enhanced relative to LBGs. And we still don't understand why, but I do know that in our calculations, when you have an outflow that's driven by star formation, you also significantly enhance the covering factor in Lyman limit system. So my speculation is that if you have a quasar-driven outflow in those halos, then that could go a long way towards explaining that high data points. That's something that I hope to check explicitly in the future.
Chris? I wanted to raise a question about a different type of feedback. It seems that it's robust conclusion in models like this to have this breathing mode behavior in the center of your galaxy. And that should leave a significant impact on the stellar orbital motions that of stars that have experienced that, and potentially also the dark matter that has been in that potential well area as well. So, could you comment on what the observable consequences of that might be?
So actually, Dushan, I think, would be in a better position to comment on that, because I believe his graduate student is actually looking at the effect of these breathing modes on dark matter halo profiles.
So we did not explore what exactly happens with stars, but a student of mine is looking what happens with central regions of dark matter halos. And in fact, kind of similar to previous work on with different kinds of feedback, we find that around 10 to 11 solar mass halos, you enhance central dark matter density significantly, such as it's mostly core-like, unlike NFW halos, which are cuspy. But by the time you get to Milky Way size halos, you still recover cusp. So it's not really affecting dark matter that much, even though for those massive halos, you would expect even steeper cusp because of adiabatic contraction. So there is some effect, and we have not quantified it yet, but we basically see almost no contraction in those halos. So it's a cuspy halo, but less cuspy than you would expect.
So do you think we'll be able to see the signature in stellar orbits with Gaia?
So actually, a student of mine is looking exactly what's happening with stars and with dark matter particles, but I don't know the answer yet.
Eve? So one, you talked about Q, and I'm curious whether you measured Q for your simulation, your fire simulations.
So we haven't.
And so, I mean, one point in particular is that from the point of view of star formation, of course, what matters is the local velocity dispersion, and often the, you know, on large scales and in observations, what's measured is a velocity dispersion over much larger scales from disk instabilities, and it's not the same one.
Yeah, so I actually agree with this this concern. That's an interesting point. So so we have not measured it in the cosmological simulation, but Phil has previously measured it in his isolated galaxy runs on which these models are based, and at least in the way that he attempted to remove non-proper turbulent velocity motion, he found a Tumriku parameter of order unity that fluctuates from place to place. But what I will say is that one prediction of this model is that in galaxies that have high gas mass fraction, the turbulent velocity dispersion should be elevated, like in ULERGs and IZ SFGs. And I think you would argue that currently it's ambiguous whether the observations support that or not because of contamination in the turbulent motion, say from streaming motion of large-scale inflows. And I would be interested to hear from the observers in the discussion what are the prospects to unambiguously measure those turbulent gas velocity dispersions as a way to discriminate between models in which Q is of order unity versus ones in which it doesn't have to be.
Okay, thanks very much, Claude Andre.